Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I think it's almost like you kind of get gaslit by the situation. It's just like, right, this is the way things are, and I need to function within that. And so you never say, I can't do that because I have a meeting at school, or I can't do that because I have to pick a kid up. You kind of go, you know, I'm sorry, I have another engagement then. And you're not particularly honest about, you know, the reasons that you're not doing certain things or that certain things aren't possible. And really, I think it's been, you know, seeing a younger generation of women being far more upfront within the art world and being really inspired by what they're doing, actually, that's made a huge difference to me, Kaylin. So, I mean, it's your generation and maybe a little older that I think they've been extraordinary, because they've really started to shift perceptions about just really basically talking about having families or just being public about it. Not necessarily doing campaigning work, but actually making that a visible part of their identity is huge.
I am so thrilled today to share in conversation with someone who spends a lot of time researching and writing about the artist mother identity. Welcome to the podcast, Hedy Judah. Hedy is the chief critic on the daily newspaper, The Eye, a columnist for Apollo Magazine, a contributing editor to The Plant, and writes regularly for The Guardian, Vogue, Frise, and a number of magazines with art in the title. She is finalizing a new book titled How Not to Exclude Artist Mothers and Other Parents, and has a book published in 2019 about Frida Kahlo. Hedy lives in London with her partner, a dog, and currently her children and two Ukrainian refugees for the summer. Hedy, welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Okay, so this feels like a long time coming, because we've kind of been living these parallel lives of researching, putting information out there, trying to offer support and encouragement to artists who are mothers. So this is just so exciting to have you on and to talk about the work you've been doing. Can you begin by telling me a little bit more about yourself and your work, just kind of some general things? And I'm curious to know if you've always wanted to be a writer.
Sure. Well, I've always been bookish and wordy and nerdy. And so I guess I may not always have wanted to have been a writer, but I guess that was, yeah, the world of words was always something that I was working within. But at the same time, I do come from a family. I'm going to say a family of artists, but I mean, that's going back a few generations. So my great grandmother studied at the Royal Academy Schools in London. So she was one of the first women in Britain to academically study the male nude, for example. Okay. I have an artist for an aunt, a couple of cousins who are artists. So I've been brought up within that world of people making things and having paintings around and being very, very lucky as a kid and going to galleries and things. So I guess those two aspects have always been there. But I guess there were other things that I wanted to do. So funnily enough, before I was writing, I did some really terrible performance art. Ooh. At college, which is probably not something I should admit to, but I feel, you know, we need to be honest on these podcasts.
Yes, you do. Awesome. And you currently live in London. You have a dog, a partner. Tell me a little bit more just about like your everyday structure of your life. You said your kids off recording, you said your kids are a bit older.
Yeah, sure. So I started my family when I was in my 20s.
Okay. Me too.
And I just turned 50 at the weekend. So both my sons have recently moved out of home. The youngest moved out of home last September, and I was heartbroken. It's not something I ever anticipated, but it's like a relationship breaking up or some kind of devastating grief. It's a real shock, because I've been an active mother for 21 years. Mm-hmm. And suddenly this huge chapter of my life seemed to be finishing. And I went really straight from that into working on another book, actually, a book that's coming out in October called Lapidarium, which is a book of essays about different stones. And that was an incredibly intense period of research. And suddenly not having the structure of childcare and having to hound people about homework, I ended up essentially writing for about 12 hours a day. It became incredibly intense.
Oh,
and it's really cathartic. Funny because, yeah, it's, but it wasn't cathartic at all. It was just, it was so panicked and and very focused. And it's funny because when you talk to artists about the difference that happens when they have children, that they can't do these huge 10 to 12 hour marathons painting anymore, you suddenly realize that this is now what I'm back into, that I've had this fragmented life, this broken attention span that we all talk about in the whole world of artist motherhood. I've had that for 21 years and suddenly I didn't have that anymore. And I was working crazy hours 7 days a week. So currently things are a little atypical. My kids have come home for the summer break. And we also have Ukrainian refugees living in the house. And we have a 3-bedroom house in London. So space is rather tight. When my children moved out, I converted one of their bedrooms into a luxurious and gorgeous office space full of lots of feminist artwork. So it's covered in, well, what we in Britain would call a fanny, but I guess you just call it a vagina over there in America. it's the other way around in these parts.
Yes.
You know, there's people giving birth, there are clitorises, there's a naked picture of me done when I was 19. And this is in my older son's bedroom, and he now has to come back and sleep in this room, glared at by me naked, age 19. So I lost this beautiful office when the children moved back in. They are in Ibiza, which is a kind of party island in the Mediterranean, for 4 days at the moment. So I'm now back in the office temporarily.
Okay.
So during the summer when they're not here, I kind of hot desk with my partner and try and find space to write. And then the rest of the day is spent with one or other person interrupting me, needing food or something printed for them or some bit of administration or the dog walked or something like that. So yeah, it's quite fragmented right now. But yeah, when the children are not here, it is this heaven of 12 hours a day of creativity.
I'm missing them. I find so much inspiration in like what you just shared, just about that transition from, you know, having this fragmented life as you described it, and as so many of our listeners and the artists in our community understand. I think that's often within that fragmented time is where I find folks need the most community and support, because, you know, splicing yourself into so many pieces throughout your day or throughout your year is really hard. It's very difficult. And I think that's, you know, for me, kind of where the precipice of this project, this podcast was born, kind of out of that anguish of the splicing. But then it's just interesting to hear, you know, you kind of have gone through these phases of circling back around to this time again that you have, and just to hear how you are filling your days, like the flood gates have opened back up, you know, everything that you've kind of held back. And I don't know, it just makes me wonder what my life will be like when my kids have left, but not in like a longing for that way. I'm actually just about to start. My youngest is 4 and he'll be going into pre-K at the end of August. And it'll be the first time that I've had, like, first time in 10 years, because my oldest is 10, that I won't have kids at home during like the school day hours. And so even that just feels like I just can't wait, you know, but also like, you can see the end, and you get that, no, don't resent this time, you know, like all these other narratives come up about how the last few weeks of summer are, this summer in particular for me, are like so precious, you know. So
I don't know, everybody always does that whole thing like, oh, it goes so fast. It's like, no, if you're the primary carer, it actually doesn't go that fast. I've really felt every one of those 21 years. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. I adore my children. I've been very invested in their lives, but no, that didn't feel like it went past in a flash at all. I would say also, when you're in that phase where you've got preschoolers at home and you the amount you can achieve in the time that they're napping and the amount you can achieve, like if you get 2 hours during the day, is just extraordinary.
Absolutely.
But I think I've burnt through that ability. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've got that incredible kind of, I mean, I've still got the focus, but I don't have that level of productivity anymore, because there were years and years where I spent, you know, they went to bed at 7:30 every evening and I did 2 or 3 hours work, pretty much 3 hours work every evening after they'd gone to bed. And I could really get a lot done then. I just can't do that anymore. I get too tired.
Mm-hmm.
So you do end up kind of, I don't know whether it's just age or you burn yourself out kind of working around the clock, trying to do everything, but
absolutely,
yeah, something gives.
Very relatable. Hedy, bring me back to some of those early memories of being inspired and influenced by art. I'm just wanting to learn a little bit more about how art was kind of in your periphery and how you eventually, you know, took this trajectory to build this career about writing about art. Like, what are some like big moments maybe that stand out for you where you feel like art was very impactful or influential early on?
Sure. I mean, I think in a way, some of it is less to do with, you know, having these relatives that always had kind of amazing drawings and paintings in their home. And actually more comes down to the time when I was at college in Glasgow. And it was a transformative moment in that city's history. There was what was called the Glasgow Miracle in retrospect happening, which was this kind of cultural rebirthing of the city. And a lot of funds had been put into the cultural sector of Glasgow at that point. But it was kind of, you know, it was a medium-sized city. It wasn't overwhelming like London. And so everybody went to see everything that was interesting happening. So there would be extraordinary avant-garde dance happening. There would be, you know, contemporary opera. There would be great photography shows. There'd be performance art. There was an incredible club scene. And when I was doing my bad performance art, that was kind of the milieu that it was happening within. And I think you never notice a scene happening when you're part of it, really. It just seems that that's the way the world is. But in retrospect, that was the most extraordinary, moment of being part of, because I was really witnessing a lot of very exciting artists coming through at that time. From Douglas Gordon to, you know, on a more humorous level, David Shrigley, dancers like Michael Clark, who in the UK is probably one of the most important contemporary choreographers, and some very important curators actually started working in Glasgow at that point. And so I was really there kind of at the start of a scene when it was very approachable, when everybody was very young, when I kind of knew the people out there. And so that was really when I actually started, I think, writing about it, because I was part of that scene. So in a way, it wasn't so much that I suddenly had this kind of big bingo moment of being inspired, but it was just that I think, you know, scenes need chroniclers. And you start to kind of write about the stuff that you essentially came of age with. And so I did very much come of age with that, in that kind of world of quite conceptual art. And it's funny because around the same time there was this big movement happening in London, which came to be quickly known as the Young British Artists, the YBAs. And funny enough, I wasn't in London at that time, although I'm a Londoner, so I kind of missed that whole world of you know, Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin and Sarah Lucas happening, although of course they've been very important to my life as well.
Right. So were you writing, when you say you began writing kind of about what you were experiencing in contemporary culture, was that for like your university newspaper, or like what kind of writing were you doing at that
time?
No,
I mean, I pretty fast I started writing for newspapers actually. So I was writing for the Times of London. I was writing for Scottish papers called the Herald, a paper called the Herald. So I pretty quickly started writing for newspapers and magazines in my 20s actually.
Interesting. Tell me a little bit about just the career trajectory of a writer. Like, I'm kind of trying to draw the parallels between being an artist where you start to show your work a little bit, you build connections. Is it the same in that, you know, it just kind of little by little builds into this like larger career and larger reputation?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's to an extent that you're building up a portfolio.
Right.
And gathering people who believe in your work and think that you're worth investing in, worth supporting, they enjoy reading or looking at what you're doing. I had a slightly atypical career trajectory in that my first, I've only been married once, but my ex-husband, I should say, was a foreign correspondent. So I left the UK when I just had my first son. So it's that funny thing where my career was very disrupted by having kids, but possibly not in the most typical way. So I moved, first of all, to DC, where I was there for a year. I was there for the year of 9/11, actually. So that was disrupting in other ways. And then I lived in Istanbul for 4 years. And was very much part of the city's art scene, actually. And then I was in Belgium for 5 years.
Wow.
And I was working quite a bit in Belgium and in Istanbul, because in very different ways, those were two cultures that accommodate children and accommodate women working in ways that actually Britain doesn't particularly well. In Istanbul, it was just kind of more normal and affordable for people to have people helping out with childcare. Childcare was really accessibly priced. In Belgium, the school day was really constructed to help women who worked. So there was this simple thing called the garderie at the end of a school day, where you basically paid in 15-minute increments for as long as you left the kid there. So in the UK, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, school finishes at 3:20 or 3:30, and you have to be there to pick your kid up at school gates. You can have after school clubs, but in general, you know, there's this, you're kind of, you know, you're glared at, you're in such trouble if you're not there to collect your kids. In Belgium, if you're not there to pick them up at 3:20, it kind of ticks around and the garderie's there until 6. So you can fit your child, you know, picking up your child around your working day, which is so much easier. All of the subways, all of the public transport's designed for prams, for buggies. All of the local municipalities have subsidized holiday clubs for the kids, so they can go off and do like a French course or a swimming course for like €70 for the week.
Wow.
During the holidays. So if you're a working parent, it's incredibly easy to, you know, to balance childcare and, you know, basically being a parent and having a career in a way that it's absolutely not in the UK. I don't know what it's like comparably in the States.
My sense is it's
rather the same.
Very much the same, in that the glaring teachers want to get out as soon as possible, you know, like, which teachers deserve to get out as soon as possible. But yeah, it's like, if you're not in car line, you know, at 2:40 to get your kids picked up, like at the right time. I mean, the only, similar to what you shared, like you can make arrangements for your kids to go to like clubs or Y Care or different things like that. But it's, I would say, like, I think the quality of the care that they receive in after school programs is very different than what they receive in like their school environment.
I mean, I think it goes down to this cultural point where it's not designed for women to work. You know, whereas in Belgium, it's assumed that all the women work.
Right.
And so if you're doing stuff on a Saturday, if you're going to like the highest high fashion shop in Belgium, people are there with their kids because, you know, they only go shopping at weekends. And if the weekends is kids' time. So it's a completely different culture. And it's really interesting how the whole of the system in the UK, and it sounds like somewhat in the US, is structured as if women working was an anomaly that somehow had to be accommodated and was a bit inconvenient.
Well, anyway,
I
think the difference is that in a society like in what you were describing in Belgium, you know, there are systems in place that are assuming that care. And in a society like the US and the UK, they're relying on women's free labor to accommodate that care for their families, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a money thing. Like, it comes down to the values of the society and where they're willing to put structural support and time and energy. I was just talking yesterday, I had lunch with two artist mothers, and my friend, one of the persons that was at lunch, had just spent several weeks with friends in Germany. And we had this very conversation where she's just talking about how, you know, the experience of her friends having kids in Germany, the school support. She was talking about how, you know, here in the US, like, kids walking to school is like a very different experience, or getting transporting your kids to and from school is very different from, she was saying, her friend's like 5-year old walks to school by themselves, and all of the houses like along the path or along like the route, if they're on a kid's walking to school route, the community members know to like keep an eye out. They stand at their window with their coffee, like watching the kids cross the street, and you know, people who aren't related to them, because that's just like what makes the community function better. Like the kids are kind of assumed as community care, and just that difference from like, you know, the basically we're sending our kids to school with bulletproof backpacks here in the US, you know? I mean, really, it's just those cultural differences, drives me crazy sometimes to think about.
Yeah, it doesn't bear thinking about, actually. So just to wheel back to the whole motherhood experience. Yeah.
we're way off the track here.
So I moved back to the UK in 2010 as a single parent. And that was really where I kind of hit the kind of the hard reality of the impact that having kids was having on my career. Because I was working, I worked first of all for a publishing house, and then I started working with a magazine. And it was just really evident that I couldn't participate in the art world at that point with two kids as a single parent. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think even if I had had a partner at that point with two primary school age children, it would have been impossible. That all of my colleagues at that point, you know, they would be going out 2 or 3 nights a week to art world events. They traveled an enormous amount. And I think this was also to do with the timing thing, because before I'd left London, the art world was much less developed. It was much less professionalized. There was far fewer galleries. The number of commercial galleries was tiny at that point. We didn't have a significant art fair at that point. We didn't have anything like the Armory. And in the period that I've been away from London, there'd obviously been a huge financial boom. There was also a financial crash, but mm-hmm. Frieze Art Fair had started. There'd been this huge boom of in the number of international galleries. So places like Gagosian had opened in London, Zwerner had opened in London. And suddenly there was this city that was awash in a commercial art scene that hadn't really existed before I'd been there, before I'd gone away. And so as a parent that needed to basically be back to kind of either collect my kids or at least be there to cook dinner, to do their homework with them.
Right.
I couldn't participate in the art world in at a kind of professional level in a way that worked for with my job. I certainly couldn't travel. So, you know, at the same time during that period, you know, the art world become far more globalized. There were art fairs all over the place. There were biennials popping up all over the place. And there was certainly a feeling that if you were an art magazine, you had to cover the art globally. The art scene globally. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, colleagues that were heading off to Brazil for kind of 2 weeks at a time, or to the Far East for 2 weeks at a time. And none of that was available to me. So having started at that magazine as a featured columnist, I basically started slipping down to essentially I was kind of, you know, just sitting in the office kind of copy editing for people. And my writing wasn't even getting into the magazine. Mm. And that was quite a kind of stark example of how difficult it is to participate in the art world, really,
right.
if you're a caregiver. And really that only changed when my kids got a bit older and I was in a relationship with somebody who was very supportive. They moved in about 6.5-7 years ago, and started being able to, for example, look after the kids if I went on a trip for a few days. I don't go to that many evening events, but they, you know, if I needed to go to an evening event, they could. Mm. And also increasingly I could go to things on Saturdays, for example, I could go and see shows. So I started then writing more. So it's really been in the last 7-8 years that I've started re-emerging, that I've started flourishing mm-hmm. again as a writer to an extent. And it was tremendously difficult getting anyone to pay attention. I had to completely recreate my career from the start. Mm. All I have as a legacy, though, is you know, decades of knowledge and decades of experience, I guess. But I certainly didn't have currency as somebody that had been around writing in the 1990s or as somebody that that even had experience working in other countries in the, in the previous decades.
Hi there, I'm Kaylin Butine.
And I'm Jamie Smith.
And we are popping in to invite you to come check out another great space in the podcast world, one we co-host together, the Thriving Artists Podcast.
The Thriving Artists Podcast offers weekly short episodes where we share tips and strategies to help you thrive in your art career and studio practice.
Episode themes range from sharing information on artist residencies, how to manage your time well, the top things you can do to professionalize your art career, and a lot of focus on our mental health, well-being, and creating systems where we feel empowered to live the lives and art careers that we want.
We hope you will head over to the Thriving Artists Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hit subscribe and join us for our weekly episodes. You can also find all of our episodes in video format and see our beautiful faces on our YouTube channel, Thriving Artists. We are here for you. We are cheering you on, and we believe in the work you are doing as thriving artists.
See you there. My next question was going to be, what inspired you to write the book, How Not to Exclude Artist Mothers and Other Parents? And I feel like you basically just answered that from your own experience of not even being an artist, but being a writer, being, you know, supporting, wanting to engage in the art world and being a mother and not even being able to do that. So is there anything else you want to say just about, you know, the inspiration for writing the book and giving voice to this very specific niche identity? And, you know, maybe a little bit about what the project looked like, how it took shape in the beginning.
Actually, you know, it's really funny because I don't think at any point during which I was having a really crummy time having to juggle motherhood and writing, did I kind of go, hey, maybe I should do something about the structure of the art world and make it more accommodating to caregivers.
You didn't? You didn't set out to burn it down? Come on, Hetty.
I think it's almost like you kind of get gaslit by the situation. It's just like, right, this is the way things are, and I need to function within that. And so you never say, I can't do that because I have a meeting at school, or I can't do that because I have to pick a kid up. You kind of go, you know, I'm sorry, I have another engagement then. And you're not particularly honest about, you know, the reasons that you're not doing certain things or that certain things aren't possible. And really, I think it's been, you know, seeing a younger generation of women being far more upfront within the art world and being really inspired by what they're doing, actually, that's made a huge difference to me, Kaylin. So, I mean, it's your generation and maybe a little older that I think they've been extraordinary because they've really started to shift perceptions about just really basically talking about having families or just being public about it, not necessarily doing campaigning work, but actually making that a visible part of their identity is huge.
Yeah.
I think that's partly because we're in a more identity driven era than I was.
Yep.
So, I mean, obviously I was, you know, kind of bring kids up pre social media and stuff. So the aspects of a person's personal life weren't particularly visible on a professional level at that point. But actually really this whole project started to coming together because there were a few really significant studies that have been done in the last few years looking at gender equality in the art world. Mm-hmm. So there was Charlotte Burns and Julia Halperin's report that was published together with ArtNet News. And there was also a series of reports done in the UK funded by the Freelance Foundation called The Representation of Female Artists in Britain. And I got talking with the author of the British report, Dr. Kate McMillan, I guess about 3-4 years ago now, and I said, you know, I'm looking at your data, and you know, it's all beautifully laid out, you've got these wonderful data visualizations, and you can see that there's a kind of parity between kind of male and female students at high school who are studying art. Probably there are actually more female students studying art than there are male. You can see at postgraduate level, it's about 50-50. There are about the same number of male and female art students. You can see at the early career awards. They're about roughly 50-50, and these are anonymously judged. About 50-50 people are getting nominated for these awards. And then suddenly there's just this big dropping off point, this big dropping off point that happens approximately around the mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of represented in these graphs by the number of artists who are represented by commercial galleries. Mm-hmm. We don't have time to go into it here, but in the book I go into why commercial galleries are so important. Mm-hmm. A lot more. But I said, I was saying to Kate, we're looking at the data and we're kind of going, sexism, 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 the art world is structurally sexist. There's other stuff going on here. And I really feel that it would be interesting to take a look at what other factors are maybe playing a role in kind of keeping female artists down and stopping, in really skewing the numbers in their 30s. And I think that the modifying factor might be motherhood. What do you think? And so she actually commissioned me to do an essay initially about the impact of motherhood on artists' careers. I have to say, I do have a previous interest in motherhood and art, and it had been something I'd wanted to do a series of books and podcasts and about kind of, I guess, about 8, 9, 10 years ago, which was to do with questions, the subjects the art world found quite taboo. And I thought the childhood and motherhood were two big ones. But actually it turned out they were too taboo and they didn't get commissioned.
Fancy that.
Fancy that. And I should say, I'm still trying to get a massive art story.
I was going to say, try again.
Published, and I know it's still seen as being a niche subject. It's really extraordinary. Anyway, so that was the start of this research, however. So Kate commissioned an essay from me, which was meant to be done for April 2020. And between her commissioning it and the start of the research, weirdly enough, suddenly, this global pandemic happened and we were all stuck in our homes. And so I put out an open call for artists to interview for the essay. And I thought I'd interview maybe 3 or 4 people. I got about 50 or 60 people replying. And at that point, I was like, well, I'm not going anywhere. So I interviewed everybody. Wow. So I did about 50, maybe more than 50 interviews with artist mothers. I've got about 500 or 600 pages of research from that, which is kind of extraordinary. And the essay, which is quite short, but it's called Full, Messy and Beautiful, really represents the results of that research. And it really looks at the different ways that motherhood has an impact on artists' careers at every stage of their career, right from, pregnancy, all the way through to, kind of dealing with older children. Mm-hmm. And also the massive issue that women face coming back into the art world once they've had a family and have a more free time available to them and try to kind of re-enter the art world in their 40s and 50s. And it's incredibly difficult. I still don't have an answer to that. And that's maybe as artist mother gets older, might become a pressing question for you all as well.
Absolutely. I think that's, something that in the community building and the podcast kind of growing that I've experienced is just the generational gaps and how, things have really changed, but also there's like kind of different ways that, artist mothers continue to experience a lot of challenges. And so just making sure that I'm not having tunnel vision about my own specific experience, but trying to give voice to some of those other things. And that's a great example of what you brought up. I would love for you to I know the book is broken up into some major sections. Would you want to just briefly describe what those sections are and how you kind of decided on, those being the legs of how you framed this conversation?
Sure. So the book really is doing something slightly different from the original essay. So having identified quite a lot of issues that artist mothers faced, I wanted to make the book more solutions-based, which is obviously why I came to you. And I there is a section in the book that talks about artist mother and the work that you do in the community that you've set up and the importance of support networks, actually. Mm-hmm. So I broke the book up into areas which, to an extent, they roughly represent the progress of an artist's career, you could say. So it goes from looking at the general culture of the art world through art school, through studio work, through residencies, through commercial gallery representation, to working with major institutions. But these were also all areas that had their own quite specific problems. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the problems accumulate. So because, for example, motherhood is not seen as, or has not been seen as, a legitimate subject for artworks at art school, and because artist mothers are not well catered for at art school, you know, this then has a kind of hangover into the kind of art that people consider to be worthy of collecting or showing in major institutions. And the lack of scholarship and the lack of, you know, art historical status for art around these subjects. So it's almost like this has a kind of cumulative effect. And so we build it up to the point where we're looking at the way that art institutions might deal with mothers and with the subject of motherhood better. And then in the conclusion, I look at some really radical solutions. And I also talk about the fact that a lot of the problems that that affect artist mothers are really symptomatic of bad habits in the art world.
Yeah.
And the way that there is an assumption in the art world that essentially everyone is wealthy and carefree and has an abundance of time and energy and mobility and can essentially, you know, accommodate the art world's bad behavior.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about the, what would you call it, an article, How Not to Exclude Artist Parents, the guidelines that you created. Like, how did that kind of come out of the project and the book? And I mean, that thing kind of went viral, right? Like, it was...
Yeah, it's been huge. So it's actually a manifesto, I think.
A manifesto, I wasn't sure what you were calling it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a manifesto. So essentially, after doing the essay that came out a couple of years ago, Full, Messy and Beautiful, you know, I immediately started thinking, what can I do to change this? Because these are issues I work in the art world. Okay, I can make a noise about it, but there must be some concrete things that we can do to change it. So this was still during the pandemic. So again, it was quite nice in a way because you could bring people into a virtual room that might otherwise have been quite difficult to bring together to have conversations. And so I brought together a group of artist mothers. There are about 30 or 40. Many of them were people that had contributed to the original study, but I also invited a few other artists into it because I wanted to have quite a few artists that were maybe more experienced and had quite established careers that could reflect on their own experiences and allow us to look at what worked and what didn't work. And essentially, we started doing this enormous sprawling Google Doc about full of what advice we'd like to give to institutions and residencies about how they could be more accommodating. And it was really extraordinary. So there's, you know, so many different things came out. And of course, what really comes out quite fast is that artists are very diverse. Mm-hmm. They have really different needs.
Absolutely.
They have really different desires. There'll be people that feel incredibly strongly that they want to make work with children in the same space as them. There will also be artists that feel incredibly strongly that they want to have time away from their kids. You know, so these, you know, there were of course many kind of separatings of the way. So going through that, we kind of worked out some 3 points that many, many people could agree on. So essentially what happened is that I guess there were kind of 20 or 30 pages of notes that we all put together, and people just kind of freely put stuff in. It could be anonymous, they could say whatever they wanted. And then if there was something that really chimed with you, you thought was important, you could put your initials next to it. So you were literally basically endorsing points. And so from that, I kind of grabbed out the 10 points that people seem to feel really strongly about. And so I kind of put them into my own words, and then people modified them and we changed them. And so it kept getting refined. So it wasn't me writing it. It was almost like I became a kind of funnel for it.
Yeah.
So I kind of catalyzed it. And then kind of with everyone's help, we kind of got it into a shape that we wanted. And I'm useless at graphic design, but there was a student at Goldsmiths, Hannah Bowles, who I'd done a bit of mentoring with, and she very kindly put them into some, you know, an attractive bit of, you know, put them into an attractively designed list. And we then created a slideshow that could go out. Essentially, we almost had 10 slides so that it would work on Instagram, which sounds really cynical, but it just allowed it to circulate.
Yep.
And very quickly, people started to say, you know, I'd really like to do these in French. I'd really like to do these in Spanish. Quite a lot of the artists that we
that I'd sort of participated were from, you know, had different mother tongues. So there were certainly Portuguese speakers, French speakers, Spanish speakers, Italian speakers. And it then really grew and grew and grew. So all of the translations were done by groups of volunteers. And so we ended up actually working out quite a good method where we'd kind of match four or five volunteers so that they could essentially edit one another. So again, it became a kind of crowdsource thing. I didn't want to burden anyone with too much work as well, because by definition, this constituency is the hardest working, most time poor constituency in the art world. We're talking about artist mothers here. So asking them to do anything felt really unkind, to be honest. And then I basically paid someone to put up a, well, James Bridle initially actually created a website for us, a free website. So I don't know if you know his work, but he's an artist and technologist and parent who lives currently in Athens, Greece. And then I basically kind of paid for a website so that it continues to circulate. I think there are 16 languages currently, and it's also audio described. And what's been lovely about that is that it's put me in touch with artist mother groups in, you know, as far away as, you know, Seoul and South Korea. And essentially some groups kind of got together because of, I mean, I think there was a group in Japan who got together essentially to translate the manifesto as a collective, and they've stayed together as an artist parent collective.
That's amazing.
It's been great. It's been a kind of coming together, kind of a point of coming together for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's kind of the effect that the podcast had that I didn't anticipate, was that community would sort of be formed because of the visibility and the kind of establishing the conversation. So it's totally relatable and really wonderful. My favorite point in that guideline, the manifesto, is, which we've already talked about, don't read gaps on a CV to indicate a lack of commitment or effort. Like, just that, the second part of that is so powerful, I think. You know, it's not.
Yeah. And what's really interesting actually is I think that the wider world is starting to address this issue as well. So I think in the last year, LinkedIn has put an option in where you can actually kind of indicate a gap in your CV, and you can say that it was because you're caring for children, or you're unwell or something.
Yeah.
And they've been promoting this and saying that people actually like to know what happened at that point in your life. And it's quite interesting. There's a group in, there's a group in Berlin called Kunst und Kind who quite militantly put childbirth onto their artist CVs. So it's funny that there's quite a lot of activism happening around this this specific area right now.
Hattie, just a few more questions for you. I'm wondering, you know, first I just want to say thank you for the work that you're doing, for using the resources that you have to write about this topic, to, you know, kind of to let it evolve. You know, you've let this topic take many forms, started with this big essay and then moved to the book, and now you have the manifesto, and just kind of breaking apart the concept in multiple ways, I think, is an important thing to do so many people can access it. I guess my question for you is, and thanks for including Artist Mother in the book. That's very meaningful for me. Just wanting to know from you, like, how, like, what is your biggest hope for this writing, for this work that you're doing, for how it exists in the world? Like, what do you want the work to do, and how do you see it kind of moving forward?
I mean, first of all, Kayla, I also should thank you for all the work that you do, because this is your huge job that you've been doing for a number of years now, and you've made a huge difference to so many people. I mean, obviously the kind of, you know, the great hope is that we no longer need to talk about this, that it's just so normal. You know, wouldn't it be great if this was just, you know, if motherhood was just seen as a normal subject in the curriculum, you didn't need to admit to it. I mean, I'm not even going to touch on the catastrophe that's going on in the States right now regarding reproductive rights, but, you know, women's rights are still under threat in many, many, many ways. This plays into that in a big way, I think, you know, acknowledging the fact that, you know, issues that concern women and women's bodies are incredibly important, and they are potentially the subject matter for great and important artworks as well. And I think motherhood is still regarded as being a bit of a weird taboo subject within feminism in general. Mm-hmm. I think that's starting to change. So, I mean, my great hope is that, you know, obviously the gender pay gap closes, we all start caring equally for children as, you know, the heterosexual couples start caring equally for their children. You know, that there's also, you know, paternity leave becomes as, you know, as easy and automatic as maternity leave. And that, you know, that women kind of also are sympathetic towards one another as they flex their muscles in the art world. We have a lot more gender equality in directorships of museums and heading up commercial galleries, but they don't necessarily always seem to be kind. Mm-hmm. And receptive towards the needs of, you know, artist caregivers, artist mothers. And I think partly that goes back to that kind of gaslighting that I was talking about earlier, yeah. Where we're kind of in it and we don't realize that we're reproducing the structures that actually made life difficult for us in the first place.
Yep.
And sometimes it's really important to kind of check ourselves and look at what else is going on. So, yes, I mean, obviously that's the hopeful endpoint. There are a few things I want to do along the way. I'm starting a group called Art Working Parents in the UK, which is actually for art workers as opposed to artists. Mm. So they can basically share their experiences and talk about things like maternity care and how they deal with travel. And, you know, that might also start to change the structure of the art world and, you know, make it more accommodating to all of us. And I still want to start a massive online network so that new artist mothers can find organizations like yours. Mm-hmm. So they don't feel so isolated. They can track down, you know, support network for themselves really easily. So those are the two things to come in the short term.
Awesome. Well, we should chat more about that because I know there's some folks also wanting to do that work. And one resource in particular that I know currently exists is the Artist Parent Index by Sarah Urban. I'm not sure if you know of that project, but yeah, I think all of that needs to happen. All of that is, you know, work that I hope continues to get out there and exist in the world. Hedy, I'm wondering if there's a piece of advice that you've been given that just really stuck with you, that was meaningful to you, or if not, what would you say to yourself, you know, 10, 20 years ago when you were kind of in that fractured state? Is there anything that you would want to encourage yourself and say now that you've kind of gone through that phase?
I'm not that wise, I don't think. I don't think I've got great advice myself. I have to say I was very ill last year and I had an out of office reply that just said I can't do any work, and it basically was just like saying no to everything. And that was the greatest thing that I've ever done. And I really miss having an out of office reply that just says, no, I can't answer any of your emails. So I think saying no to things. I've noticed actually there are a few artist parents now that have such things. So yeah, learning mm-hmm. when to say no to things, yep. making space for yourself. I don't think that really constitutes advice, but I think as tools that you can exercise are really, really good. So having an out of office reply that automatically says, you know, I'm preserving the most precious resource I have, which is my time to think and create. And I will get back to some emails when I have the time.
Yes.
You know, just that as something that you can do is, that's kind of simple, but just making a bit of space for yourself and not feeling like you always need to reply to everything immediately and do everything that's offered to you.
Absolutely. Have you read the book Burnout? That's going on my list as we continue to share resources, but yeah, I have done that email autoresponder and I always include a quote from that book where it basically says, you know, instead of continuing to respond to patriarchal systems that want to blah, 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 I'm turning inward and taking time for myself. You know, like I just like pulled a direct quote from that book when I put that autoresponder on. So I'm right there with you. Okay, Hedy, last question before we do our final five. What does success mean to you?
I think it would be being given the resources to pursue the writing projects that really interest me. which is something that I've actually, I mean, I quite rarely get to do. Quite often my writing projects have been things that have been proposed to me. Yeah, so things like the big book on, a big art historical book on art and motherhood. It's still not something I found a publisher for because, yeah, it's still seen as being a bit of an out there subject, weirdly, but it is.
Well, I definitely hope that success comes to you soon. Okay, we're going to close our interview with five final questions just for our audience to get to know you a little bit better. Who is your biggest art crush?
So is this like a sexy crush or is it like a, I like that art?
I can't believe crush. You're the first person who asked me that.
So like a sexy crush. So I'm at the moment, I've just been preparing an illustrated talk on the introduction of the book. So I've been looking at some of the artist mothers that I kind of pick up in the introduction of the book. And there's one called Jacqueline Nomba, who was married to André Breton. And my God, she's so gorgeous. And when she met André Breton, she was performing naked burlesque in a tank of water. And that's just the most extraordinary photograph of her body in this. But she was a fantastic friend with Claude Cahun and various other artists. And she's really stunning. And she had a relationship with Frida Kahlo. Frida Kahlo painted, she did a painting for her, which is all of these opening fruits. And Jacqueline Nomba appears as this little kind of blonde doll looking over the edge of the fruits, kind of looking a bit worried about this blossoming fruitiness that's going on in her life. Okay. If it's not a sexy crush, I'm going to have a thruple. Am I allowed a thruple?
Yes, it's allowed. Okay.
If it's not a sexy crush, my thruple will be with Paula Rego and Alice Neal.
Awesome. What a good way to answer that question. I can't believe you're the first person who was like, I mean, you mean like a physical sex crush, right? Hedy, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on?
I've always wanted to go to Japan. I would love to go to Japan. Yeah, if anybody has a great project for me to go to in Japan, please phone me immediately.
Tell me about a book or a film that has been a big inspiration to you.
Oh, blimey. Doing my stone book, Lapidarium, there was this extraordinary book that was recommended to me by an anthropo-archaeological friend of mine called The Mind in the Cave by a guy called David Lewis Williams, who's a South African anthropo. He's a cave art expert, which basically looks at the origins of art. So the very, very first art, rock art, and the figure of the artist in the basically the Paleolithic community. And the idea is the artist is the first person who essentially has power, not because they're violent or they're born into power. So it's not because you're strong or you've inherited power, but you have a kind of shamanic power. And this idea that the earliest art was kind of connecting to some kind of spiritual power, some kind of spiritual realm. I'm not a particularly spiritual person, but the book kind of blew me away. Actually, it was really, a really amazing book.
Say the title one more time.
The Mind in the Cave.
The Mind in the Cave. Okay.
Awesome. That's quite heavy. I have to say that's quite a heavy book. And just as like a more motherhood book, I guess. I mean, like probably everybody else, Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts was mind-blowingly good.
Yep. Awesome. Favorite meal?
It's summer and I would say anything with artichokes in them. I did like artichokes with garlic and mint cooked in white wine.
Yum. Okay. And finally, who would you like to give a shout out to or thank for supporting you in your work?
I have to give a shout out to my partner, Ben Leahy, because he has made so much of my work in the last few years possible. In the UK, I have to shout out to Diana Gravina, who obviously is, as you know, the queen of all things artist mother in the UK. And I really have to give a shout out to Dr. Kate McMillan, who has done, she's an artist and a researcher, and she really opened the door for me to start work in this area and gave me the first commission to really write about artist mothers, and she's an inspiration in every way.
Awesome. Hedy, where can people find out more about you and your writing, and where can they access the work that you're doing?
Well, I am in the middle of changing my absolutely terrible website, which is just hettyjuda.co.uk. I'm active on Instagram, very easy to find on Instagram. And How Not to Exclude Artist Mothers and Other Parents will be available on Amazon at the end of September.
Awesome.
If you want to find the manifesto, it's just artist-parents.com. And it's there in, I think, 16 languages. So wherever you are, you can find it in the language that works for you. And if it doesn't exist in the language that works for you, get in touch if you'd like us to translate it.
Perfect. Thank you so much. This has been great. And again, just thanks for providing the platform and doing the writing and research that you're doing. It's just so great to be in this moment with people like you doing this work. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun talking.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.